aims that existed only in the heads of a dozen individuals, for the events and results now lie before us. But how did that old man, alone, in opposition to the general opinion, so truly discern the importance of the people's view of the events that in all his activity he was never once untrue to it? The source of that extraordinary power of penetrating the meaning of the events then occurring lay in the national feeling which he possessed in full purity and strength. Only the recognition of the fact that he possessed this feeling caused the people in so strange a manner, contrary to the Tsar's wish, to select him, an old man in disfavour, to be their representative in the national war. And only that feeling placed him on the highest human pedestal from which he, the commander-in-chief, devoted all his powers, not to slaying and destroying men, but to saving and showing pity on them. That simple, modest, and therefore truly great figure could not be cast in the false mould of a European hero, the supposed ruler of men that history has invented. To a lackey no man can be great, for a lackey has his own conception of greatness. Chapter 6. Kutuzov at Krasnoye. The 5th of November was the first day of what is called the Battle of Krasnoye. Toward evening, after much disputing and many mistakes made by generals who did not go to their proper places, and after adjutants had been sent about with counter-orders, when it had become plain that the enemy was everywhere in flight and that there could and would be no battle, Kutuzov left Krasnoye and went to Dobroye, whither his headquarters had that day been transferred. The day was clear and frosty. Kutuzov rode to Dobroye on his plump little white horse, followed by an enormous suite of discontented generals who whispered among themselves behind his back. All along the road, groups of French prisoners captured that day, there were 7,000 of them, were crowding to warm themselves at campfires. Near Dobroye, an immense crowd of tattered prisoners buzzing with talk and wrapped and bandaged in anything they had been able to get hold of, were standing in the road beside a long row of unharnessed French guns. At the approach of the commander-in-chief, the buzz of talk ceased, and all eyes were fixed on Kutuzov, who, wearing a white cap with a red band and a padded overcoat that bulged on his round shoulders, moved slowly along the road on his white horse. One of the generals was reporting to him where the guns and prisoners had been captured. Kutuzov seemed preoccupied and did not listen to what the general was saying. He screwed up his eyes with a dissatisfied look as he gazed attentively and fixedly at these prisoners, who presented a specially wretched appearance. Most of them were disfigured by frostbitten noses and cheeks, and nearly all had red, swollen and festering eyes. One group of the French stood close to the road, and two of them, one of whom had his face covered with sores, were tearing a piece of raw flesh with their hands. There was something horrible and bestial in the fleeting glance they threw at the riders, and in the malevolent expression with which, after a glance at Kutuzov, the soldier with the sores immediately turned away and went on with what he was doing. Kutuzov looked long and intently at these two soldiers. He puckered his face, screwed up his eyes, and pensively swayed his head. At another spot he noticed a Russian soldier laughingly patting a Frenchman on the shoulder, saying something to him in a friendly manner, and Kutuzov, with the same expression on his face, again swayed his head.
"What were you saying?"
he asked the general, who, continuing his report, directed the commander-in-chief's attention to some standards captured from the French and standing in front of the Preobrazhensk regiment.
"Ah, the standards," said Kutuzov,
evidently detaching himself with difficulty from the thoughts that preoccupied him. He looked about him absently. Thousands of eyes were looking at him from all sides, awaiting a word from him. He stopped in front of the Preobrazhensk regiment, sighed deeply, and closed his eyes. One of his suite beckoned to the soldiers carrying the standards to advance and surround the commander-in-chief with them. Kutuzov was silent for a few seconds, and then, submitting with evident reluctance to the duty imposed by his position, raised his head and began to speak. A throng of officers surrounded him. He looked attentively around at the circle of officers, recognizing several of them.
"I thank you all," he said, addressing the soldiers and then again the officers.
In the stillness around him, his slowly uttered words were distinctly heard.
"I thank you all for your hard and faithful service. The victory is complete, and Russia will not forget you. Honor to you forever."
He paused and looked around.
"Lower its head, lower it,"
he said to a soldier who had accidentally lowered the French eagle he was holding before the Preobrazhensk standards.
"Lower, lower, that's it. Hurrah, lads,"
he added, addressing the men with a rapid movement of his chin.
"Hurrah!"
roared thousands of voices. While the soldiers were shouting, Kutuzov leaned forward in his saddle and bowed his head, and his eye lit up with a mild and apparently ironic gleam.
"You see, brothers,"
said he when the shouts had ceased, and all at once his voice and the expression of his face changed. It was no longer the commander-in-chief speaking, but an ordinary old man who wanted to tell his comrades something very important. There was a stir among the throng of officers and in the ranks of the soldiers, who moved that they might hear better what he was going to say.
"You see, brothers, I know it is hard for you, but it can't be helped. Bear up. It won't be for long now. We'll see our visitors off and then we'll rest. The Tsar won't forget your service. It's hard for you, but still you are at home. While they, you see what they have come to,"
said he, pointing to the prisoners.
"Worse off than our poorest beggars. While they were strong, we didn't spare ourselves, but now we may even pity them. They are human beings too. Isn't it so, lads?"
He looked around, and in the direct, respectful, wondering gaze fixed upon him, he read sympathy with what he had said. His face grew brighter and brighter with an old man's mild smile, which drew the corners of his lips and eyes into a cluster of wrinkles. He ceased speaking and bowed his head as if in perplexity.
"But after all, who asked them here? Serves them right, the bloody bastards!"
he cried, suddenly lifting his head, and flourishing his whip, he rode off at a gallop for the first time during the whole campaign, and left the broken ranks of the soldiers laughing joyfully and shouting, "Hurrah!" Kutuzov's words were hardly understood by the troops. No one could have repeated the field marshal's address, begun solemnly and then changing into an old man's simple-hearted talk. But the hearty sincerity of that speech, the feeling of majestic triumph combined with pity for the foe and consciousness of the justice of our cause, exactly expressed by that old man's good-natured expletives, were not merely understood, but lay in the soul of every soldier and found expression in their joyous and long-sustained shouts. Afterwards, when one of the generals addressed Kutuzov, asking whether he wished his calèche to be sent for, Kutuzov, in answering, unexpectedly gave a sob, being evidently greatly moved. Chapter 7. Encampment for the Night. When the troops reached their night's halting place on the 8th of November, the last day of the Krasnoye battles, it was already growing dark. All day it had been calm and frosty, with occasional lightly falling snow, and toward evening it began to clear. Through the falling snow a purple, black and starry sky showed itself, and the frost grew keener. an infantry regiment which had left Tarutino 3,000 strong, but now numbered only 900, was one of the first to arrive that night at its halting place, a village on the high road. The quartermasters who met the regiment announced that all the huts were full of sick and dead Frenchmen, cavalrymen, and members of the staff. There was only one hut available for the regimental commander. The commander rode up to his hut. The regiment passed through the village and stacked its arms in front of the last huts. Like some huge, many-limbed animal, the regiment began to prepare its lair and its food. One part of it dispersed and waded knee-deep through the snow into a birch forest to the right of the village, and immediately the sound of axes and swords, the crashing of branches, and merry voices could be heard from there. Another section, amid the regimental wagons and horses which were standing in a group, was busy getting out cauldrons and rye biscuit and feeding the horses. A third section scattered through the village, arranging quarters for the staff officers, carrying out the French corpses that were in the huts and dragging away boards, dry wood and thatch from the roofs for the campfires or wattle fences to serve for shelter. Some 15 men with merry shouts were shaking down the high wattle wall of a shed, the roof of which had already been removed.
"Now then, all together, shove!" cried the voices,
and the huge surface of the wall, sprinkled with snow and creaking with frost, was seen swaying in the gloom of the night. The lower stakes cracked more and more, and at last the wall fell, and with it the men who had been pushing it. Loud, coarse laughter and joyous shouts ensued.
"Now then, catch hold in twos, hand up the lever, that's it. Where are you shoving to? Now then, all together, but wait a moment, boys, with a song."
All stood silent, and a soft, pleasantly velvet voice began to sing. At the end of the third verse, as the last note died away, 20 voices roared out at once,
"Oh, that's it, all together, heave away, boys."
But despite their united efforts, the wattle hardly moved, and in the silence that followed, the heavy breathing of the men was audible.
"Here, you are the sixth company, devils that you are, lend a hand, will you? You may want us one of these days."
Some 20 men of the 6th Company, who were on their way into the village, joined the haulers, and the wattle wall, which was about 35 feet long and 7 feet high, moved forward along the village street, swaying, pressing upon and cutting the shoulders of the gasping men.
"Get along, falling! What are you stopping for? There now!"
Merry, senseless words of abuse flowed freely.
"What are you up to?"
suddenly came the authoritative voice of a sergeant major, who came upon the men who were hauling their burden.
"There are gentry here. The general himself is in that hut. And you, foul-mouthed devils, you brutes, I'll give it to you!"
shouted he, hitting the first man who came in his way a swinging blow on the back.
"Can't you make less noise?"
The men became silent. The soldier who had been struck groaned and wiped his face, which had been scratched till it bled by his falling against the wattle.
"There, how that devil hits out! He's made my face all bloody!"
said he in a frightened whisper when the sergeant-major had passed on.
"Don't you like it?"
said a laughing voice, and moderating their tones, the men moved forward. When they were out of the village, they began talking again as loud as before, interlarding their talk with the same aimless expletives. In the hut which the men had passed, the chief officers had gathered and were in animated talk over their tea about the events of the day and the manoeuvres suggested for tomorrow. It was proposed to make a flank march to the left, cut off the vice-king, Murat, and capture him. By the time the soldiers had dragged the wattle fence to its place, the campfires were blazing on all sides, ready for cooking. The wood crackled, the snow was melting, and black shadows of soldiers flitted to and fro all over the occupied space where the snow had been trodden down. Axes and choppers were plied all around. Everything was done without any orders being given. Stores of wood were brought for the night, shelters were rigged up for the officers, cauldrons were being boiled, and muskets and accoutrements put in order. The wattle wall the men had brought was set up in a semicircle by the 8th Company as a shelter from the north, propped up by musket rests, and a campfire was built before it. They beat the tattoo, called the roll, had supper, and settled down round the fires for the night, some repairing their footgear, some smoking pipes, and some stripping themselves naked to steam the lice out of their shirts. Chapter 8. One would have thought that under the almost incredibly wretched conditions the Russian soldiers were in at that time, lacking warm boots and sheepskin coats, without a roof over their heads, in the snow with 18 degrees of frost, and without even full rations, the commissariat did not always keep up with the troops, they would have presented a very sad and depressing spectacle. On the contrary, the army had never, under the best material conditions, presented a more cheerful and animated aspect. This was because all who began to grow depressed or who lost strength were sifted out of the army day by day. All the physically or morally weak had long since been left behind, and only the flower of the army, physically and mentally, remained. More men collected behind the wattle fence of the 8th Company than anywhere else. Two sergeants major were sitting with them, and their campfire blazed brighter than others. For leave to sit by their wattle, they demanded contributions of fuel.
"Hey, Makeyev, what's become of you, you son of a bitch? Are you lost or have the wolves eaten you? Fetch some more wood!"
shouted a red-haired and red-faced man, screwing up his eyes and blinking because of the smoke, but not moving back from the fire.
"And you, Jackdaw, go and fetch some wood," said he to another soldier.
This red-haired man was neither a sergeant nor a corporal, but being robust, he ordered about those weaker than himself. The soldier they called Jackdaw, a thin little fellow with a sharp nose, rose obediently and was about to go, but at that instant there came into the light of the fire the slender, handsome figure of a young soldier carrying a load of wood.
"Bring it here, that's fine."
They split up the wood, pressed it down on the fire, blew at it with their mouths and fanned it with the skirts of their greatcoats, making the flames hiss and crackle. The men drew nearer and lit their pipes. The handsome young soldier who had brought the wood, setting his arms akimbo, began stamping his cold feet rapidly and deftly on the spot where he stood.
"Mother, the dew is cold but clear. It's well that I'm a musketeer,"
he sang, pretending to hiccup after each syllable.
"Look out, your soles'll fly off,"
shouted the red-haired man, noticing that the sole of the dancer's boot was hanging loose.
"What a fellow you are for dancing!"
The dancer stopped, pulled off the loose piece of leather and threw it on the fire.
"Right enough, friend,"
said he, and having sat down, took out of his knapsack a scrap of blue French cloth and wrapped it round his foot.
"It's the steam that spoils them,"
he added, stretching out his feet toward the fire.
"They'll soon be issuing us with new ones. They say that when we've finished hammering them, we're to receive double kits. And that son of a bitch Petrov has lagged behind after all, it seems,"
said one sergeant major.
"I've had an eye on him this long while," said the other. "Well, he's a poor sort of soldier."
"But in the 3rd Company they say 9 men were missing yesterday."
"Yes, it's all very well, but when a man's feet are frozen, how can he walk?" "Hey, don't talk nonsense,"
said a sergeant major.
"Do you want to be doing the same?"
said an old soldier, turning reproachfully to the man who had spoken of frozen feet.
"Well, you know,"
said the sharp-nosed man they called Jackdaw in a squeaky and unsteady voice, raising himself at the other side of the fire.
"A plump man gets thin, but for a thin one it's death. Take me now. I've got no strength left,"
he added, with sudden resolution turning to the sergeant major.
"Tell him to send me to hospital. I'm aching all over. Anyway, I shan't be able to keep up."
"That'll do, that'll do,"
replied the sergeant major quietly. The soldier said no more, and the talk went on.
"What a lot of those Frenchies were taken today. And the fact is that not one of them had what you might call real boots on,"
said a soldier, starting a new theme.
They were no more than make-believes.
The Cossacks have taken their boots. They were clearing the hut for the colonel and carried them out. It was pitiful to see them, boys, put in the dancer. As they turned them over, one seemed still alive. And would you believe it, he jabbered something in their lingo.
But they're a clean folk, lads, the first man went on. He was white as birch bark, and some of them are such fine fellows, you might think they were nobles.
Well, what do you think? They make soldiers of all classes there.
But they don't understand our talk at all, said the dancer with a puzzled smile. I asked him whose subject he was, and he jabbered in his own way. A queer lot.
But his strange friends, continued the man who had wondered at their whiteness. The peasants at Mozhaisk were saying that when they began burying the dead, where the battle was, you know, well, those dead had been lying there for nearly a month, and says the peasant, they lie as white as paper, clean, and not as much smell as a puff of powder smoke.
Was it from the cold? Asked someone.
You're a clever fellow. From the cold, indeed. Why, it was hot. If it had been from the cold, ours wouldn't have rotted either. But he says, go up to ours, and they're all rotten and maggoty. So he says, we tie our faces up with kerchiefs and turn our heads away as we drag 'em off. We can hardly do it. But theirs, he says, are as white as paper, and not so much a smell as a whiff of gunpowder.
All were silent.
It must be from near food, said the sergeant major. They used to gobble the same food as the gentry.
No one contradicted him.
That peasant near Mozhaisk, where the battle was, said the men were all called up from 10 villages around, and they carted for 20 days, and still didn't finish carting the dead away. And as for the wolves, he says, that was a real battle, said an old soldier. It's the only one worth remembering. But since that, it's only been tormenting folk.
And you know, Daddy, the day before yesterday, we ran at them, and my word, they didn't let us get near before they just threw down their muskets and went on their knees. Pardon, they say.
That's only one case. They say Platov took Polian himself twice, but he didn't know the right charm. He catches him and catches him, no good. He turns into a bird in his hands and flies away. There's no way of killing him either.
You're a first-class liar, Kiselyov, when I come to look at you.
Liar, indeed! It's the real truth.
If he fell into my hands when I caught him, I'd bury him in the ground with an aspen stake to fix him down. What a lot of men he's ruined.
Well, anyhow, we're going to end it. He won't come here again, remarked the old soldier, yawning.
The conversation flagged, and the soldiers began settling down to sleep.
Look at the stars. It's wonderful how they shine. You would think the women had spread out their linen, said one of the men, gazing with admiration at the Milky Way.
That's a sign of a good harvest next year.
We shall want some more wood.
You warm your back and your belly gets frozen. That's queer.
Oh, Lord.
What are you pushing for? Is the fire only for you? Look how he's sprawling.
In the silence that ensued, the snoring of those who had fallen asleep could be heard. Others turned over and warmed themselves, now and again exchanging a few words. From a campfire 100 paces off came a sound of general merry laughter.
"Hark at them roaring there in the 5th company, said one of the soldiers. And what a lot of them there are.
One of the men got up and went over to the 5th company.
They're having such fun, said he, coming back. 2 Frenchies have turned up. One's quite frozen, and the other's an awful swaggerer. He's singing songs.
Oh, I'll go across and have a look.
And several of the men went over to the 5th company. Chapter 9. The 5th company was bivouacking at the very edge of the forest, A huge campfire was blazing brightly in the midst of the snow, lighting up the branches of trees heavy with hoarfrost. About midnight they heard the sound of steps in the snow of the forest and the crackling of dry branches.
"A bear, lads," said one of the men.
They all raised their heads to listen. And out of the forest into the bright firelight stepped two strangely clad human figures, clinging to one another. These were two Frenchmen who had been hiding in the forest. They came up to the fire, hoarsely uttering something in a language our soldiers did not understand. One was taller than the other. He wore an officer's hat and seemed quite exhausted. On approaching the fire, he had been going to sit down, but fell. The other, a short, sturdy soldier with a shawl tied round his head, was stronger. He raised his companion and said something, pointing to his mouth. The soldiers surrounded the Frenchman, spread a greatcoat on the ground for the sick man, and brought some buckwheat porridge and vodka for both of them. The exhausted French officer was Rambal, and the man with his head wrapped in the shawl was Morel, his orderly. When Morel had drunk some vodka and finished his bowl of porridge, he suddenly became unnaturally merry and chattered incessantly to the soldiers, who could not understand him. Rambal refused food and, resting his head on his elbow, lay silent beside the campfire, looking at the Russian soldiers with red and vacant eyes. Occasionally he emitted a long-drawn groan and then again became silent. Morel, pointing to his shoulders, tried to impress on the soldiers the fact that Rambal was an officer and ought to be warmed. A Russian officer who had come up to the fire sent to ask his colonel whether he would not take a French officer into his hut to warm him, and when the messenger returned and said that the colonel wished the officer to be brought to him, Rambal was told to go. He rose and tried to walk, but staggered and would have fallen had not a soldier standing by him held him up.
"You won't do it again, eh?"
said one of the soldiers, winking and turning mockingly to Rambal.
"Oh, you fool, why talk rubbish, lout that you are? A real peasant," came rebukes from all sides, addressed to the jesting soldier.
They surrounded Rambal, lifted him on the crossed arms of two soldiers, and carried him to the hut. Rambal put his arms around their necks while they carried him, and began wailing plaintively.
"Oh, you fine fellows, my kind, kind friends, these are men, oh, my brave, kind friends."
And he leaned his head against the shoulder of one of the men like a child. Meanwhile, Morel was sitting in the best place by the fire, surrounded by the soldiers. Morel, a short, sturdy Frenchman with inflamed and streaming eyes, was wearing a woman's cloak and had a shawl tied woman-fashion round his head over his cap. He was evidently tipsy, and was singing a French song in a hoarse, broken voice, with an arm thrown round the nearest soldier. The soldiers simply held their sides as they watched him.
Now then, teach us how it goes, I'll soon pick it up. How is it?"
said the man, a singer and a wag, whom Morel was embracing.
"Vive Henri IV, vive le roi vaillant," sang Morel, winking. "Ce diable quatre! Vive Henri IV, vive le roi vaillant, ce diable quatre!"
repeated the soldier, flourishing his arm and really catching the tune.
"Bravo! Ha ha!"
rose their rough, joyous laughter from all sides. Morel, wrinkling up his face, laughed too.
"Well, go on, go on. Qui eut le triple talent de boire, de battre, et d'être envers galant. It goes smoothly, too. We'll know. Zalatayev."
"Qui,"
Zalatayev brought out with effort.
"Qui,"
he drawled laboriously, pursing his lips.
"Le triple talent de boudre, de bonde, et de travaglar,"
he sang.
"Fine! Just like the Frenchie! Do you want some more to eat?
Give him some porridge. It takes a long time to get filled up after starving."
They gave him some more porridge, and Morel, with a laugh, set to work on his third bowl. All the young soldiers smiled gaily as they watched him. The older men, who thought it undignified to amuse themselves with such nonsense, continued to lie at the opposite side of the fire, but one would occasionally raise himself on an elbow and glance at Morel with a smile.
"They are men too," said one of them as he wrapped himself up in his coat. "Even wormwood grows on its own root."
"Oh, Lord, oh, Lord, how starry it is! Tremendous! That means a hard frost."
They all grew silent. The stars, as if knowing that no one was looking at them, began to disport themselves in the dark sky, now flaring up, now vanishing, now trembling. They were busy whispering something gladsome and mysterious to one another.
Chapter 10. The Crossing of the Berezina. The French army melted away at the uniform rate of a mathematical progression, and that crossing of the Berezina, about which so much has been written, was only one intermediate stage in its destruction, and not at all the decisive episode of the campaign. If so much has been and still is written about the Berezina on the French side, this is only because of the broken bridge across that river, the calamities their army had been previously enduring were suddenly concentrated at one moment into a tragic spectacle that remained in every memory, and on the Russian side, merely because in Petersburg, far from the seat of war, a plan, again one of Pfuel's, had been devised to catch Napoleon in a strategic trap at the Berezina River. Everyone assured himself that all would happen according to plan, and therefore insisted that it was just the crossing of the Berezina that destroyed the French army. In reality, the results of the crossing were much less disastrous to the French in guns and men lost than Krasnoye had been, as the figures show. The sole importance of the crossing of the Berezina lies in the fact that it plainly and indubitably proved the fallacy of all the plans for cutting off the enemy's retreat, and the soundness of the only possible line of action, the one Kutuzov and the general mass of the army demanded, namely, simply to follow the enemy up. The French crowd fled at a continually increasing speed, and all its energy was directed to reaching its goal. It fled like a wounded animal, and it was impossible to block its path. This was shown not so much by the arrangements it made for crossing as by what took place at the bridges. When the bridges broke down, unarmed soldiers, people from Moscow, and women with children who were with the French transport, all, carried on by vis inertiae, pressed forward into boats and into the ice-covered water and did not surrender. That impulse was reasonable. The condition of fugitives and of pursuers was equally bad. As long as they remained with their own people, each might hope for help from his fellows and the definite place he held among them. But those who surrendered, while remaining in the same pitiful plight, would be on a lower level to claim a share in the necessities of life. The French did not need to be informed of the fact that half the prisoners, with whom the Russians did not know what to do, perished of cold and hunger, despite their captors' desire to save them. They felt that it could not be otherwise. The most compassionate Russian commanders, those favourable to the French, and even the Frenchmen in the Russian service, could do nothing for the prisoners. The French perished from the conditions to which the Russian army was itself exposed. It was impossible to take bread and clothes from our hungry and indispensable soldiers to give to the French, who, though not harmful or hated or guilty, were simply unnecessary. Some Russians even did that, but they were exceptions. Certain destruction lay behind the French, but in front there was hope. Their ships had been burnt, there was no salvation save in collective flight, and on that the whole strength of the French was concentrated. The farther they fled, the more wretched became the plight of the remnant, especially after the Berezina, on which, in consequence of the Petersburg plan, special hopes had been placed by the Russians, and the keener grew the passions of the Russian commanders, who blamed one another, and Kutuzov most of all.
Anticipation that the failure of the Petersburg-Beryozina plan would be attributed to Kutuzov led to dissatisfaction, contempt and ridicule, more and more strongly expressed. The ridicule and contempt were, of course, expressed in a respectful form, making it impossible for him to ask wherein he was to blame. They did not talk seriously to him. When reporting to him or asking for his sanction, they appeared to be fulfilling a regrettable formality, but they winked behind his back and tried to mislead him at every turn. Because they could not understand him, all these people assumed that it was useless to talk to the old man, that he would never grasp the profundity of their plans, that he would answer with his phrases, which they thought were mere phrases, about a golden bridge, about the impossibility of crossing the frontier with a crowd of tatterdemalions and so forth. They had heard all that before, and all he said, that it was necessary to await provisions, or that the men had no boots, was so simple, while what they proposed was so complicated and clever, that it was evident that he was old and stupid, and that they, though not in power, were commanders of genius. After the junction with the army of the brilliant admiral and Petersburg hero Wittgenstein, this mood and the gossip of the staff reached their maximum. Kutuzov saw this and merely sighed and shrugged his shoulders. Only once, after the affair of the Beryozina, did he get angry and write to Bennigsen, who reported separately to the Emperor, the following letter. "On account of your spells of ill health, will your Excellency please be so good as to set off for Kaluga on receipt of this, and there await further commands and appointments from His Imperial Majesty?" But after Bennigsen's departure, the Grand Duke Tsarevich Konstantin Pavlovich joined the army. He had taken part in the beginning of the campaign, but had subsequently been removed from the army by Kutuzov. Now, having come to the army, he informed Kutuzov of the Emperor's displeasure at the poor success of our forces and the slowness of their advance. The Emperor intended to join the army personally in a few days' time. The old man, experienced in court as well as in military affairs, this same Kutuzov, who in August had been chosen commander-in-chief against the sovereign's wishes, and who had removed the Grand Duke and heir apparent from the army, who, on his own authority and contrary to the Emperor's will, had decided on the abandonment of Moscow, now realized at once that his day was over, that his part was played, and that the power he was supposed to hold was no longer his. And he understood this not merely from the attitude of the court. He saw, on the one hand, that the military business in which he had played his part was ended, and felt that his mission was accomplished, and at the same time he began to be conscious of the physical weariness of his aged body and of the necessity of physical rest. On the 29th of November, Kutuzov entered Vilna, his dear Vilna, as he called it. Twice during his career, Kutuzov had been governor of Vilna. In that wealthy town, which had not been injured, he found old friends and associations, besides the comforts of life, of which he had so long been deprived. And he suddenly turned from the cares of the army and state, and as far as the passions that seethed around him allowed, immersed himself in the quiet life to which he had formerly been accustomed, as if all that was taking place and all that had still to be done in the realm of history did not concern him at all. Chikagov, one of the most zealous cutters-off and breakers-up, who had first wanted to effect a diversion in Greece and then in Warsaw, but never wished to go where he was sent, Chikagov, noted for the boldness with which he spoke to the Emperor and who considered Kutuzov to be under an obligation to him, because when he was sent to make peace with Turkey in 1811, independently of Kutuzov, and found that peace had already been concluded, he admitted to the Emperor that the merit of securing that peace was really Kutuzov's. This Chikagov was the first to meet Kutuzov at the castle where the latter was to stay. In undress naval uniform with a dirk and holding his cap under his arm, he handed Kutuzov a garrison report and the keys of the town.
The contemptuously respectful attitude of the younger men to the old man in his dotage was expressed in the highest degree by the behaviour of Chichagov, who knew of the accusations that were being directed against Kutuzov. When speaking to Chichagov, Kutuzov incidentally mentioned that the vehicles packed with China that had been captured from him at Borisov had been recovered and would be restored to him.
"You mean to imply that I have nothing to eat out of? On the contrary, I can supply you with everything, even if you want to give dinner parties," warmly replied Chichagov, who tried by every word he spoke to prove his own rectitude and therefore imagined Kutuzov to be animated by the same desire.
Kutuzov, shrugging his shoulders, replied with his subtle, penetrating smile,
"I meant merely to say what I said."
Contrary to the Emperor's wish, Kutuzov detained the greater part of the army at Vilna. Those about him said that he became extraordinarily slack and physically feeble during his stay in that town. He attended to army affairs reluctantly, left everything to his generals, and while awaiting the Emperor's arrival, led a dissipated life. Having left Petersburg on the 7th of December with his suite, Count Tolstoy, Prince Volkonsky, Arakcheyev, and others, the Emperor reached Vilna on the 11th, and in his travelling sleigh drove straight to the castle. In spite of the severe frost, some 100 generals and staff officers in full parade uniform stood in front of the castle, as well as a guard of honour of the Semyonov Regiment. A courier who galloped to the castle in advance in a troika with 3 foam-flecked horses shouted, "Coming!" and Konovnitsyn rushed into the vestibule to inform Kutuzov, who was waiting in the hall porter's little lodge. A minute later, the old man's large, stout figure in full dress uniform, his chest covered with orders and a scarf drawn round his stomach, waddled out into the porch. He put on his hat with its peaks to the sides, and holding his gloves in his hand and walking with an effort sideways down the steps to the level of the street, took in his hand the report he had prepared for the Emperor. There was a running to and fro and whispering, another troika flew furiously up, and then all eyes were turned on an approaching sleigh in which the figures of the Emperor and Volkonsky could already be descried. From the habit of 50 years, all this had a physically agitating effect on the old general. He carefully and hastily felt himself all over, readjusted his hat, and pulling himself together, drew himself up, and at the very moment when the Emperor, having alighted from the sleigh, lifted his eyes to him, handed him the report, and began speaking in his smooth, ingratiating voice. The Emperor, with a rapid glance, scanned Kutuzov from head to foot, frowned for an instant, but immediately mastering himself, went up to the old man, extended his arms, and embraced him. And this embrace, too, owing to a long-standing impression related to his innermost feelings, had its usual effect on Kutuzov, and he gave a sob. The Emperor greeted the officers and the Semyonov guard, and again pressing the old man's hand, went with him into the castle. When alone with the field marshal, the Emperor expressed his dissatisfaction at the slowness of the pursuit and at the mistakes made at Krasnoye and the Beryozina, and informed him of his intentions for a future campaign abroad. Kutuzov made no rejoinder or remark. The same submissive, expressionless look with which he had listened to the Emperor's commands on the field of Austerlitz 7 years before settled on his face now. When Kutuzov came out of the study and with lowered head was crossing the ballroom with his heavy, waddling gait, he was arrested by someone's voice saying, "Your Serene Highness!" Kutuzov raised his head and looked for a long while into the eyes of Count Tolstoy, who stood before him holding a silver salver on which lay a small object. Kutuzov seemed not to understand what was expected of him. Suddenly, he seemed to remember. A scarcely perceptible smile flashed across his puffy face, and bowing low and respectfully, he took the object that lay on the salver. It was the Order of St. George of the First Class. Chapter 11.
Next day the field marshal gave a dinner and ball, which the emperor honoured by his presence. Kutuzov had received the Order of St. George of the first class, and the emperor showed him the highest honours, but everyone knew of the imperial dissatisfaction with him. The proprieties were observed, and the emperor was the first to set that example, but everybody understood that the old man was blameworthy and good for nothing. When Kutuzov, conforming to a custom of Catherine's day, ordered the standards that had been captured to be lowered at the emperor's feet on his entering the ballroom, the emperor made a wry face and muttered something in which some people caught the words, "the old comedian." The emperor's displeasure with Kutuzov was specially increased at Vilna by the fact that Kutuzov evidently could not or would not understand the importance of the coming campaign. When, on the following morning, the emperor said to the officers assembled about him, "You have not only saved Russia, you have saved Europe," they all understood that the war was not ended. Kutuzov alone would not see this, and openly expressed his opinion that no fresh war could improve the position or add to the glory of Russia, but could only spoil and lower the glorious position that Russia had gained. He tried to prove to the emperor the impossibility of levying fresh troops, spoke of the hardships already endured by the people, of the possibility of failure, and so forth. This being the field marshal's frame of mind, he was naturally regarded as merely a hindrance and obstacle to the impending war. To avoid unpleasant encounters with the old man, the natural method was to do what had been done with him at Austerlitz and with Barclay at the beginning of the Russian campaign, to transfer the authority to the emperor himself, thus cutting the ground from under the commander-in-chief's feet without upsetting the old man by informing him of the change. With this object, his staff was gradually reconstructed and its real strength removed and transferred to the emperor. Toll, Konovnitsyn, and Ermolov received fresh appointments. Everyone spoke loudly of the field marshal's great weakness and failing health. His health had to be bad for his place to be taken away and given to another. And in fact, his health was poor. So, naturally, simply and gradually, just as he had come from Turkey to the treasury in Petersburg to recruit the militia, and then to the army when he was needed there, now, when his part was played out, Kutuzov's place was taken by a new and necessary performer. The War of 1812, besides its national significance dear to every Russian heart, was now to assume another, a European significance. The movement of peoples from west to east was to be succeeded by a movement of peoples from east to west, and for this fresh war another leader was necessary, having qualities and views differing from Kutuzov's and animated by different motives. Alexander I was as necessary for the movement of the peoples from east to west and for the refixing of national frontiers as Kutuzov had been for the salvation and glory of Russia. Kutuzov did not understand what Europe, the balance of power, or Napoleon meant. He could not understand it. For the representative of the Russian people, after the enemy had been destroyed and Russia had been liberated and raised to the summit of her glory, there was nothing left to do as a Russian. Nothing remained for the representative of the national war but to die. And Kutuzov died. Chapter 12. Pierre's Illness and Recovery at Oryol. As generally happens, Pierre did not feel the full effects of the physical privation and strain he had suffered as a prisoner until after they were over. After his liberation, he reached Oryol, and on the third day there, when preparing to go to Kiev, he fell ill and was laid up for 3 months. He had what the doctors termed bilious fever. But despite the fact that the doctors treated him, bled him, and gave him medicines to drink, he recovered. Scarcely any impression was left on Pierre's mind by all that had happened to him from the time of his rescue till his illness. He remembered only the dull grey weather, now rainy and now snowy, internal physical distress and pains in his feet and side. He remembered a general impression of the misfortunes and sufferings of people, and of being worried by the curiosity of officers and generals who questioned him. He also remembered his difficulty in procuring a conveyance and horses, and above all, he remembered his incapacity to think and feel all that time. On the day of his rescue, he had seen the body of Petya Rostov. That same day, he had learned that Prince Andrei, after surviving the Battle of Borodino for more than a month, had recently died in the Rostovs' house at Yaroslavl. And Denisov, who told him this news, also mentioned Hélène's death, supposing that Pierre had heard of it long before. All this at the time seemed merely strange to Pierre. He felt he could not grasp its significance. Just then he was only anxious to get away as quickly as possible from places where people were killing one another, to some peaceful refuge where he could recover himself, rest, and think over all the strange new facts he had learned. But on reaching Oryol, he immediately fell ill. When he came to himself after his illness, he saw in attendance on him two of his servants, Terenty and Vaska, who had come from Moscow, and also his cousin, the eldest princess, who had been living on his estate at Eletz, and hearing of his rescue and illness, had come to look after him. It was only gradually during his convalescence that Pierre lost the impressions he had become accustomed to during the last few months, and got used to the idea that no one would oblige him to go anywhere tomorrow, that no one would deprive him of his warm bed, and that he would be sure to get his dinner, tea, and supper. But for a long time in his dreams, he still saw himself in the conditions of captivity. In the same way, little by little, he came to understand the news he had been told after his rescue about the death of Prince Andrei, the death of his wife, and the destruction of the French. A joyous feeling of freedom, that complete, inalienable freedom natural to man, which he had first experienced at the first halt outside Moscow, filled Pierre's soul during his convalescence. He was surprised to find that this inner freedom, which was independent of external conditions, now had, as it were, an additional setting of external liberty. He was alone in a strange town, without acquaintances. No one demanded anything of him or sent him anywhere. He had all he wanted. The thought of his wife, which had been a continual torment to him, was no longer there, since she was no more. "Oh, how good, how splendid," said he to himself when a cleanly laid table was moved up to him with savoury beef tea, or when he lay down for the night on a soft, clean bed, or when he remembered that the French had gone and that his wife was no more. "Oh, how good, how splendid." And by old habit he asked himself the question, "Well, and what then? What am I going to do?" And he immediately gave himself the answer, "Well, I shall live." Ah, how splendid! The very question that had formerly tormented him, the thing he had continually sought to find, the aim of life, no longer existed for him now. That search for the aim of life had not merely disappeared temporarily, he felt that it no longer existed for him, and could not present itself again. And this very absence of an aim gave him the complete joyous sense of freedom which constituted his happiness at this time. He could not see an aim, for he now had faith. Not faith in any kind of rule or words or ideas, but faith in an ever-living, ever-manifest God. Formerly, he had sought him in aims he set himself. That search for an aim had been simply a search for God, and suddenly in his captivity he had learned, not by words or reasoning, but by direct feeling, what his nurse had told him long ago, that God is here and everywhere. In his captivity he had learned that in Karatayev God was greater, more infinite and unfathomable than in the architect of the universe recognized by the Freemasons. He felt like a man who, after straining his eyes to see into the far distance, finds what he sought at his very feet. All his life he had looked over the heads of men around him, when he should have merely looked in front of him, without straining his eyes. In the past he had never been able to find that great, inscrutable, infinite something. He had only felt that it must exist somewhere, and had looked for it. In everything near and comprehensible, he had seen only what was limited, petty, commonplace, and senseless. He had equipped himself with a mental telescope and looked into remote space, where petty worldliness, hiding itself in misty distance, had seemed to him great and infinite merely because it was not clearly seen. And such had European life, politics, Freemasonry, philosophy, and philanthropy seemed to him. But even then, at moments of weakness, as he had accounted them, his mind had penetrated to those distances, and he had there seen the same pettiness, worldliness, and senselessness. Now, however, he had learned to see the great, eternal, and infinite in everything, and therefore, to see it and enjoy its contemplation, he naturally threw away the telescope through which he had till now gazed over men's heads, and gladly regarded the ever-changing, eternally great, unfathomable, and infinite life around him. And the closer he looked, the more tranquil and happy he became. That dreadful question, what for, which had formerly destroyed all his mental edifices, no longer existed for him. To that question, what for, a simple answer was now always ready in his soul. Because there is a God, that God without whose will not one hair falls from a man's head. Chapter 13. In external ways, Pierre had hardly changed at all. In appearance, he was just what he used to be. As before, he was absent-minded and seemed occupied not with what was before his eyes, but with something special of his own. The difference between his former and present self was that formerly, when he did not grasp what lay before him or was said to him, he had puckered his forehead painfully, as if vainly seeking to distinguish something at a distance. At present, he still forgot what was said to him, and still did not see what was before his eyes, but he now looked with a scarcely perceptible and seemingly ironic smile at what was before him, and listened to what was said, though evidently seeing and hearing something quite different. Formerly, he had appeared to be a kind-hearted but unhappy man, and so people had been inclined to avoid him. Now, a smile at the joy of life always played round his lips, and sympathy for others shone in his eyes with a questioning look as to whether they were as contented as he was, and people felt pleased by his presence. Previously he had talked a great deal, grew excited when he talked, and seldom listened. Now he was seldom carried away in conversation, and knew how to listen so that people readily told him their most intimate secrets. The princess, who had never liked Pierre and had been particularly hostile to him since she had felt herself under obligations to him after the old count's death, now, after staying a short time in Auriol, where she had come intending to show Pierre that in spite of his ingratitude she considered it her duty to nurse him, felt to her surprise and vexation that she had become fond of him. Pierre did not in any way seek her approval. He merely studied her with interest. Formerly she had felt that he regarded her with indifference and irony, and so she had shrunk into herself as she did with others, and had shown him only the combative side of her nature. But now he seemed to be trying to understand the most intimate places of her heart, and mistrustfully at first, but afterwards gratefully, she let him see the hidden, kindly sides of her character. The most cunning man could not have crept into her confidence more successfully, evoking memories of the best times of her youth and showing sympathy with them. Yet Pierre's cunning consisted simply in finding pleasure in drawing out the human qualities of the embittered, hard, and in her own way, proud princess. Yes, he is a very, very kind man when he is not under the influence of bad people, but of people such as myself, thought she. His servants, too, Terenti and Vaska, in their own way noticed the change that had taken place in Pierre. They considered that he had become much simpler. Terenty, when he had helped him to undress and wished him good night, often lingered with his master's boots in his hands and clothes over his arm to see whether he would not start a talk, and Pierre, noticing that Terenty wanted a chat, generally kept him there.
"Well, tell me, now, how did you get food?" he would ask.
And Terenty would begin talking of the destruction of Moscow and of the old count, and would stand for a long time holding the clothes and talking, or sometimes listening to Pierre's stories, and then would go out into the hall with a pleasant sense of intimacy with his master and affection for him. The doctor,